Hi, I'm Bradley Simmons, personal trainer to some of the UK's most loved celebrities, football icons and Olympic athletes. With so many opinions flying around and influencers influencing, it's time to weigh up what is fact, what is fiction and what needs more focus. On today's episode, we have Dr. Curran, an NHS surgeon taking social media by storm, busting the myths around health and explaining what the TikTok health trends really mean. He is the perfect guest for this podcast as we delve into what is fact and what is fiction and why it's so important that we know the truth when it comes to our well-being. With 500,000 Instagram followers, 5.1 million TikTok followers and 29,000 newsletter subscribers, Dr. Curran is making a difference, not just in the theatre room, but across our devices worldwide. Dr. Curran, it is great to have you on the podcast. I have been seeing you on YouTube Reels, YouTube Shorts, I say they're called, Instagram Reels, you're flying, mate. Content is brilliant and I thought it'd be great to have you on just to educate my following and I guess your following as well.
Yeah, thank you for having me on, man.
Yeah, are you busy at the minute? What's going on?
Well, right now, it's we're in the middle of doctor strikes.
Yes, a few questions in here about
junior
that.
Doctors striking, so that. But this happens to be my day off anyway.
Okay, nice.
So it's a strike day, but I also have a day off anyway. And just generally, yeah, a few exciting things in the works. I've got my book that I'm announcing soon.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a busy time.
So you got a book out finally?
Finally got a book out. It's coming out in December, but obviously I'm announcing it now and it just feels surreal to announce it to everyone because I've been working on it for months. I've never written something so big before. So,
How long did it take you to write?
Somewhere between a year and a year and a half.
Yeah,
but I've been planning it for months before then as well. And I never thought I wanted to write a book. I've only written scientific publications that I've published, you know, for scientific journals and medical journals, but never anything as big as this. And I didn't think I could do it, but somehow got over the line.
Yeah, good. And did book publishers come to you or did you go to them with your idea?
So,
because obviously you're going viral right now. So that's
So I was approached by probably about year before last, I was approached by about 10 publishers who just emailed me or like, you know, DM'd me or whatever, the different editors. And then even after I went with one publisher, I still got people, you know, oh, have you thought about this, that? And, you know, it feels nice to people want you to write a book for their company or for their publishing company.
It's a business, isn't it? They need to make the profit.
But then saying no, because I've already gone with one, you know.
So loyalty is key.
Yeah, I mean, because you've signed a contract with one publisher, so you can't talk to anyone else or entertain it. But, you know, I've gone with a big publisher, hopefully, who can help me, like, you know, achieve what I want with this book.
Well, good, mate. I did my book about 4 years ago now. It was very successful and it definitely opens a lot of windows, a lot of doors. So, mate, I'm buzzing for you. All that hard work paying off. All right, as it is facts over feelings, I like to start with a fact. And this is a study I recently read. So University of South Australia researchers are calling for exercise to be mainstay approach for managing depression as a new study shows that physical activity is 1.5 times more effective than counselling or the leading medication, so antidepressants. What's your thoughts on that?
I mean, when you look at mental health, you know, or just in health in general, there are different pillars. You've got mental health, which I would like to think about as the roof. And the actual pillars which support that roof is physical health, you know, diets, nutrition, social contacts, all these sort of things. And if any one of those points in the building or the structures were removed, the entire building would collapse. So you need all aspects of health, both physical and mental, to work in, you know, combination with the other things as well. So in that study, they've mentioned, obviously, exercise as a key factor in mental health and depression specifically. Yeah, sure. There will be a percentage of people who will maybe be able to improve their mental health significantly enough to get them out of the ruts if they improved or increased the amount they exercise. Going from a very sedentary lifestyle, which we know can be a risk factor for poor mental health, improving that from a baseline of zero to increasing it. Yeah, sure. But I think that simplifies the complexity of mental health and depression, and it misses some of the nuances. There'll be people who are, you know, got a six pack and are elite fitness professionals who have severe depression. And actually, you know, in the bodybuilding circuit, there are people who have body dysmorphia with higher rates of body dysmorphia than the average person, who have very poor mental health. They are some of, you know, the fittest people on the planet. Sports people as well. So I think it's unfair to say that just exercise can improve depression, because it's a very complex thing. There's nuances, you know, there's body image, eating disorders can play a role, you know, poor social contacts, you're not seeing your friends or family enough. Neurochemically inside the brain, there's a, you know, could be things going on. So you need a combination of things. And for some people, they may require antidepressants. They may require various sort of things. And obviously now psychedelics getting increased focus on their role. So I think there's all sorts of things. Exercise is a small part.
Yes, and I like your approach. But do you reckon there's some doctors out there who are just going, look, here's antidepressants, see you later?
Of course, you know.
Listen, so that's probably what the study is probably trying to showcase, that the vast majority of people are living sedentary lives, as you say, aren't eating healthy, and they're in a rut.
Yeah.
They're miserable, they're depressed. And it's just like, no, just the physical exercise, eat better food, and you might get out of that rut, and that could be the start. Is that the vast majority? Yes, you mentioned people in my industry. I know they've been down. There's been times where I've been down, I would say depressed, but I've never needed to do antidepressants. But there are probably some. And would you say that's a small minority, or would you say that's a big minority?
So, yeah, there'll be a lot of people, a lot of doctors, and I may have done it in the past as well. In fact, I probably have, where we see certain symptoms. Low mood, poor focus, low energy, you know, irritable bowels, diarrhea, constipation. These are all symptoms of something larger. Mm-hmm. And it's easy for us as doctors and healthcare workers to just treat the symptoms and not the underlying cause. If someone comes in with constipation, constipation is not a diagnosis. It's a symptom of something else, whether it's low fiber, diverticular disease, irritable bowel, whatever it is. I can give laxatives to the patient, and that treats the symptoms. It papers over the cracks.
Yeah.
But that's not targeting the actual problem. Why are they constipated? Have they got low thyroid issues? Have they got this? Have they got that? So until I target that underlying issue, I'm never going to sort out the main problem. So even with depression, you can give someone antidepressants, but then what is the underlying factor that's, you know, causing their issues? Is it because they're worried about their finances, or they're worried about they're undergoing some sort of trauma or processing some trauma in their life? Maybe they need some adjunctive therapy to that. Do they need CBT? Do they need to talk to a therapist? Yeah. Do they need to improve their exercise? So there's all sorts of
things. Loads of factors, isn't there?
Yeah, so antidepressants, you know, helps to treat the symptoms, and that is important to kind of start to change their mindset and their mood. So then you can begin other therapies to take into effect.
Yes, because my approach would be, if I was really struggling, like the last thing I want to do is go on antidepressants. I don't want to go on any medication. I'm a very keep it natural good sort of guy. So I would do everything I can to get myself back into a good mental state through exercise, get myself out of the situation. So maybe moving places, moving from that bad environment, put me in that place. Because I remember when I was in a bad rut, living in West London, I decided to move to Southwest London, just by the river, being by a bit of water, and that changed the game for me. I decided to go on more hiking holidays rather than the Ibizas.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? So I changed up my lifestyle, which made a massive difference. And not that I ever needed to be on antidepressants, but I feel like sometimes changing lifestyle, realizing who you surround yourself with, stepping away from certain type of groups or people, and you can really like find yourself and be a better person yourself. You see so many people moving to Bali, for example, right now, regular vitamin D. They're training every single day. The vibe is completely different to London.
Oh, yeah.
Do you understand? So it's like, if you're in a really rut, instead of going for the antidepressants, maybe can you just change your lifestyle? And that could change the game. I'm not saying 100%.
Yeah, and I think, you know, depression is like a spectrum, right? When I used to work in psychiatry, when I was first started, my first couple of years as a doctor, one of the rotations I had was in acute mental health. So I would often go with the acute mental health nurses on their community visits, and we'd see patients with severe psychotic depression. And, you know, these are people who are, you know, there's some people living in the home. They've got a huge hole in the roof. Water's leaking in. The entire house is surrounded with, you know, empty baked bean tins and old newspapers and random, you know, the house is a clutter. They're just lying on the sofa, depressed, not moving, disheveled. And that's severe depression. And then you've got the other end where someone, you know, you or I just talking, either one of us could be depressed, could be suffering with low mood. Depression doesn't have a stereotype where it's that, you know, stereotype. So you can be almost doing your everyday activities, but actually inside, you're breaking inside. So there's a whole spectrum. So for someone maybe at the milder end of depression, potentially, who suffers with, you know, bouts of low mood and things like that, I think definitely a huge part of it could be lifestyle. And for every stage in that spectrum of depression, one of the core things that you should also look at is maybe changing lifestyle. Do you need to, you know, have new people in your life or remove certain bad influences in your life? The support network that you rely on, maybe you need to look at your finances. Like you said, changing location. Are you getting enough sunshine and enough outdoors time?
Exactly,
because low vitamin D has an impact on the mood, and from the psychological side of things, it has a significant impact. So yeah, lifestyle factors is a huge sort of thing to be aware of as well. So as a doctor who's maybe treating people with depression and mental health conditions, you know, you look at the biopsychosocial model. You know, from the biological point of view, you've got medication. From the psychological point of view, can you talk about, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy, discussing with other people, all sorts of things. And from the social point of view, your finances, your support network, your family, exercise, all these other things. So you need all three aspects of the biopsychosocial model to work together to treat that person's mental health condition.
100%. And I had a good friend of mine, Fraser Franks, on my previous podcast, and he went down the alcohol route where he was drinking alcohol to, things didn't work out footballing wise. He had a heart condition. He had to stop playing football. He had a few beers turned into 6-7 beers.
Yeah.
And he became an alcoholic. And then he had financial pressure. And then he was depressed. Do you understand? I think a lot of men right now with the financial pressure in today's world are going down that route. I was saying to Fraser, I see a lot of my friends can't wait to get to the pub. They cannot wait to have a Guinness. I'm like, I'll have a Guinness. I'm not rushing to get a Guinness. And I see a lot of a pattern in men where alcohol can just lead down to depression.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, when you're looking at someone and you're looking at their history, if they've got depression, you're looking for substance abuse. And it could be hardcore class A drugs to just simple vices like smoking, alcohol, occasional marijuana use and things like that. Yeah. And these are all risk factors which can increase your risk of mental health issues, not just depression, but all sorts of things, you know, psychotic breakdowns and, you know, various other things like that. Specifically with smoking, alcohol, no one's saying it's easy to quit any of those things, but that it often is a big factor that worsens or at least maintains that status quo in someone's life. I had a friend of mine who's been 100 days sober from alcohol now.
Yeah.
And I can objectively see a significant change in not just his physical appearance and skin and his brightness, but his energy, his alertness, cognitive function. And he's just a changed person. You know, he was a shell of a person when he was drinking. I mean, he was drinking 1 or 2 pints a day after work.
Yeah.
This guy's a doctor.
Yes.
And he's completely different.
As a doctor
different.
As well, you need to be switched on.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that pressure? Because a lot of doctors are under pressure right now. So it is going to 1 or 2 beers just to relax. You go home.
I don't know the specific statistics on the rates of alcohol and substance abuse in doctors or healthcare workers in specific, but I suspect it may be high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, I'm just hypothesizing. There's potential that it could be even higher than the average population because you're in a high-stress job. And what your body craves when it's undergoing high stress is some sort of comfort, some sort of endorphin release, some sort of dopamine release. And that could be, for a lot of people, in the form of exercise.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, go back to that study. Instead of that 1-2 pints of beer, that study goes to show if you do a 5K run or you're going to do a CrossFit class, you're going to get a stress release.
I mean, you know, I've said exercise is one form, but then those doctors may reach for some sort of substance abuse.
Yeah.
And the thing is, you know, we've got various areas in the brain which are associated with the feeling of reward and the reward circuitry. One of those areas is the nucleus accumbens. And, you know, this is one of the areas which just blows up when someone has an orgasm. And also it's the areas that simulated by caffeine, cocaine, amphetamines, etc. And you can get this similar sort of high with exercise. You get the release of endorphins, which are natural opioids, painkillers in the body, and various other hormones which make you feel good. Now, again, this goes to show that exercise can be a tool to use in your armory to combat low mood, but it's not the only thing which will and can work.
100%. And on the topic of men, I want to talk about testosterone.
Mm.
I think that is the big one because, well, I've seen a lot of things on Twitter. Men are losing their testosterone. Men back in the 1960s had far more testosterone than men today. Is that a true or is that a myth?
You know, I've not come across a significant series of studies back to back which suggest there's some epidemiological comparative study from decades ago versus now.
Yeah.
You know, from what I'm aware of, kind of the normal range of testosterone for men, somewhere between 300 to 1,000 nanograms per deciliter.
How do you measure that? How can I every day go on and measure my testosterone today?
Yeah, you can't measure your testosterone at home. You need a blood test to work out your serum testosterone. And, you know, they will. That's the kind of accurate way of determining your testosterone, you know, but a gross screening of someone's testosterone, again, this is not likely to be highly accurate, but kind of a rough way is, what's your focus like? What's your energy like? What is your sexual function like, your libido? Yes. Are you suffering with erectile dysfunction? Are you getting regular erections in the morning or at nighttime? How are you feeling in your mood? Are you gaining excessive weight without knowing why? Are you able to build muscle? There's so many things. Psychological point of view as well, the testosterone has a role in mental health. So apart from sexual health, mental health, physical health, all of these factors you can see, are they kind of optimized or are they being affected somehow? And is that maybe because of low testosterone?
And how, for example, I've seen lack of sleep, so sleep deprived.
Mm.
Sleep is a way to drop your testosterone levels. If you're chronically stressed, is a way to drop your testosterone levels. I even saw if you're in a sauna for too long or you have a hot bath, it's going to affect your testosterone levels.
So yeah, that is a myth that circulates around a lot. So, you know, your testicles are designed to keep your sperm function optimized and the creation of the sperm. So if it gets too hot, your testicles drop down. The Dartos muscle, which is a muscle within the scrotum, the Dartos muscle is a muscle within the scrotum that relaxes and it drops your testicles down. So almost the sperm are cooled and the testicles are cooled to provide an optimum temperature for sperm function. If it's too cold, the testicles wants to warm up a little bit. The Dartos muscle contracts and it raises your testicles up. So that's the way for your testicles to almost maintain homeostasis, to provide a perfect environment for sperm function. Because if it's too hot or too cold, it's not the right environment to create good sperm or even create normal sperm. So that high heat doesn't affect testosterone particularly, but it affects the sperm function potentially over a long period of time. But like you said about the sleep, yeah, absolutely. You know, poor sleep is one way to absolutely blunt your testosterone production. Not just because if you're chronically sleep deprived, you get a rise in these, well, an excessive rise in these stress hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, which can affect the sperm function, but also because in those sleep stages, particularly those deeper sleep stages where you get growth hormone release, the NREM stages where you get testosterone release, you might miss those or you might not get enough of those REM or NREM sleep stages. So you lose out on peak testosterone function.
Wow. Mad. And how can you boost your testosterone? Is there any natural ways? So I saw ice baths. Training after an ice bath can really boost your testosterone. I saw eating red onions can really boost your testosterone. I've seen high protein from animal sources can really boost your testosterone. Are these myths or are they true?
There's some truths in all of these things. So with regards to the onions and testosterone, that it's not in humans. There have been studies done in rodents, which have shown that, eating compounds that are seen in onions can boost testosterone in rat models. Again, not clinically applicable directly to humans. Sleeping well, optimizing your sleep, we've discussed for the same reasons. Bad sleep reduces testosterone. Good sleep brings it back to a good baseline level. With regards to the ice baths and testosterone, I have not seen any studies which links, you know, consistently testosterone and ice baths.
This is a trend right now, and the type of people that are doing the ice baths are the fitness gurus. It could be another way to sell.
Yeah, so there's this kind of association bias.
Yes.
You know, there's people who are very, very concerned about every minute aspect of their health will be optimizing everything. They'll be training well, they'll be sleeping well, so they'll have adequate to above average testosterone levels, and they will also probably do this kind of classic wellness bro thing of ice plunges and ice baths. Yeah. And they'll attribute the ice bath to their virility and their high testosterone, but it's not. It's all the other things. They're sleeping, they're training, their diet. Yeah. And lastly, you mentioned about the high animal protein. I mean, specifically, lots of red meat specifically doesn't say you will have more testosterone based on that. naturally, if you prioritize protein in your diet and make sure that you have a good protein intake, that will obviously optimize and encourage muscle protein synthesis, allow you to build as much muscle as you can yes. for whatever you're training. So yeah, protein is a component to allow you to build muscle if you do strength training to then optimize yes. your testosterone.
So whether you're vegan or animal-based, it doesn't really matter as long as you're getting that good protein in.
Yeah, not so much. I mean, there's obviously different sources where you get the protein, but at the end of the day, you know, if you get enough protein and you yes. train well and you make sure you take care of all these other things, you'll be fine. But yeah. it's important to know that overtraining can blunt testosterone.
Of course.
You know, overtraining well, syndrome.
When I overtrain, I'm absolutely exhausted. I have to film my Get It Done pre-recorded workout. So I film 15 workouts in 3 days.
Wow.
Because I have to do that, obviously, for my clients, for my subscribers. Mm. And honestly, I'm ill after every single time. I'm so low. I'm absolutely exhausted. I don't even sleep well. I'm that exhausted.
Yeah.
And obviously, I want to maintain my physique. So 2-3 days later, I'm trying to weight train and I lose my strength. Oof. So it's time just to completely rest.
Rest,
yeah. And I say that to all my clients, for example, my online clients. They're like, Brad, I want to do 7 workouts a week. So no. 2 days are really important for rest. Rest is just as important as pushing yourself. So let's really push yourself in those training sessions. Let's stay active. Let's get your 10, 15,000 steps a day. But those 2 days, I just want you to mobilize, I want you to stretch, I want you to hydrate, I want you just to chill. Let your body recover and get that good sleep in. I'm going to take a minute out of this podcast now to talk about one of the companies I'm involved in, Leap Academy. Now, I've always been interested in helping others follow my path in the fitness industry and get qualified. And about a year ago, I was presented with an opportunity to work with some other great experts in the field to deliver courses to get you qualified. Leap Academy launched in Jan 2022 and the response has been incredible so far, with 600 current students to become PTs and nutritionists. If you're interested in joining the fitness industry, I would 100% recommend Leap Academy. Our courses are fully flexible so you can study around your work schedule and family commitments. And our prices are amazing value. If you want to find out more, check out the link in my Instagram bio or DM me. You can use the code BRAD2023 for 30% off.
Overtraining is not going to, you know, help you gain any more muscle.
No.
Because at some point there's micro tears in the muscle fibers. They just need to heal. That's part of the hypertrophy, part of the rest and recovery. If you just keep training, those micro tears won't have an adequate opportunity to repair.
Yeah.
And you won't see any improvement. You'll actually go backwards.
Yes, 100%. And let's go back to testosterone. So what are the negative effects of steroid use, especially in men? I don't particularly go to the gyms where I see a lot of steroid use. I know there's certain gyms where you see those lads with the little fists that are just covering those nipples.
Yeah,
got the gym shark on. What is the negative effects of steroid use, and who should be using steroids? Because some people do need steroids, people are lacking testosterone, they're prescribed by doctors. But when can it be abusive, and when should youngsters start realizing they shouldn't be taking it?
So obviously the kind of steroids that I prescribe in hospital are for to settle inflammation of the colon in patients who've got inflammatory bowel disease or some sort of immunosuppressive effect. That's the why I would prescribe them. Yeah. If someone's got a chest infection and, you know, part of
asthma
that process.
I had asthma as a kid.
Exactly, you know, for lung conditions, bowel conditions, all sorts. But the kind of testosterone abuse, obviously, we're talking about is testosterone, things like that. And the thing is, there's very minor type side effects, increased acne, maybe some mood fluctuations, increased irritability, things like that. And you get progressively more serious functions, shrinkage to the testicles, affecting the sexual function, erectile dysfunction, sperm function, abnormal sperm motility.
So looking great, but not having no sex drive.
Of course.
What's the point? What's the point?
You know, testicular
atrophy.
You're
trying to pull a bird and you can't even get horny.
I mean... You look great, but you might not feel great, affect the mental health. And then even more serious, it can affect your cardiovascular function, your kidney function, increase your risk of, adverse cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes.
Yeah, wow.
So all of these things, you've got to bear in mind as well that obviously you're taking the testosterone to potentially, you know, gain more muscle. But this muscle is also gained in other various parts of the body where maybe it shouldn't be gained. Your heart is a muscle, and you'll gain muscle around the heart. Yeah. You'll get, you know, hypertrophy of the cardiac muscle, which is not good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see in sports persons who have these sudden cardiac arrests where they'll just, you know, collapse to the ground. Christian Eriksen, Fabrice Muamba a few years ago.
Yeah.
Now, Christian Eriksen didn't have hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or things like that, as far as we're aware. But, you know, this is one of the, you know, causes of these things for testosterone. It can cause all sorts of effect for every body system. So it should be taken very lightly, shouldn't be taken very lightly. And if you're taking testosterone, it should be done with a professional 100%. For medical purposes.
So for example, with women taking HRT during the menopause stage, obviously you've got estrogen, testosterone and progesterone, right? Mm. They're the three, got it spot on. Can they take testosterone levels? Because obviously we're going to deteriorate slightly. Our testosterone's going to drop. We're going to feel a little bit older. A little bit of testosterone must be a good thing as we get older.
Yeah, of course. You know, it drops rapidly sort of after the age of 40, I would say. It drops rapidly decade on decade after that. And it's important for women as well to have testosterone to a certain extent. Yeah. But for men, I would say they feel more acutely the effects of very low testosterone. And yeah, you know, if you're experiencing those things we discussed, erectile dysfunction, loss of bone density, poor mood, and then you get a blood test and you have low testosterone, that's an indication to get testosterone replacement therapy. And, you know, that's completely fine and that's not a taboo thing, but that is for a specific medical reason because you're feeling the effects of low testosterone. An average man who has an average testosterone level, they can raise their testosterone with various other means. Mm-hmm. Like we mentioned, optimizing sleep, optimizing your workout routine. The first shortcut, the port of call should not be, let me get some testosterone injections and supplements.
Yes. And what would you say is optimal health for a human being? Is it a low body fat percentage? Is it high muscle mass? Is it able to run a half a marathon in a day's notice? What would you class as optimal health for a human being a doctor?
Yeah, optimal health, like you said, is not having a six pack, is not, you know, having, you know, muscles the size of a tree trunk.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily all those things because we know that all those things, to get to that route, you might be compromising your health in various ways.
Okay.
You know, going on restrictive diets, you know, going on all sorts of crazy supplements and all sorts to get to that route. For me, optimal health is someone who is sleeping very well, mm-hmm. who is having a great dump, a perfect bowel routine, who can move around freely without pain, who can, you know, lift heavy objects, who can run around, got good stamina, good sexual function, have good emotional regulation so they can control their stress and their mental health, has good social contacts. There's all these other more important determinants of health, which are not just purely based around aesthetics. Having muscle is important, especially with age.
Massively.
You know, if you've got a high percentage of fat, obviously there's intricacies about that, you know, visceral versus subcutaneous fat, but muscle, it's more important to gain muscle than lose fat. You know, in sort of the grand scheme of things. Like I said, there's nuances. Obviously you don't want excessively high amount of visceral fat or visceral adiposity.
Well, because you can say this, a lot of slim people have high levels of visceral fat through their diet and their sedentary lifestyle. They call it skinny fat, right?
Yeah, skinny fat basically means that you've got low amounts of subcutaneous fat and you may have lots of visceral adiposity. And, you know, that kind of adiposity, when you think about the accumulation of fat cells, you can have kind of these hypertrophic fat cells and hyperplastic fat cells, where you get hyperplastic adiposity, where you have just lots of fat cells. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. That's usually found in subcutaneous fats. And it has a better metabolic profile than the hypertrophic adiposity, which is the fat cells actually enlarge. And when they enlarge, they can burst and they begin to lose their function and they're not optimized at being fat cells anymore. And that's the type of fat cell and the adiposity we see associated with visceral fat.
How can you reduce that? Is that simply just by exercising and improving your nutrition?
So, you know, things like reducing smoking, exercising more, and limiting the amount of ultra-processed foods that you eat. Yes. Those are three core things.
Well, 70% of our diet in the UK right now is ultra-processed.
I wouldn't be surprised. Even in the hospital canteen, you know, the definition of something that is ultra-processed is you take something like a chicken, and then you ultra-process it, so it ends up looking not like the thing it originated from. And in the hospital canteen, they'll serve me lamb stew, and it won't look like it's ever been derived from lamb. or they'll serve me some turkey meatballs. It doesn't look like any meatballs I've ever seen. So if it, you know, that's...
Are you concerned about the food in hospitals?
Oh, massively. You know...
Because if that's what's there fueling you and you've got to do surgeries...
The food that I eat in the canteen is the same food that's often served to the patients.
Yes.
So, you know, if you're... We look at hospitals and the healthcare environment as beacons of wisdom and good health, but the actual food they're fueling us through 12-hour shifts, yeah, 6-hour surgeries, on-call night shifts is terrible. And the patients are also getting that. It often has low nutritional value, low nutritional density. It's not palatable at all.
Yeah.
It's stodgy, has a very odd skew of macronutrients. You'll have an excessively high amount of fats and carbohydrates, and it has a low amount of protein and fiber, you know, and it's hypercalorific as well, despite not being very satiating.
Yes.
It's a very odd mix, and it's very expensive as well.
Well, it's very expensive to purchase at the hospital.
If I, so last week when I was at work, I bought from the canteen some rice and some meatballs. That's all they had.
Rice and meatballs.
Right? And they gave me 4 meatballs
and
a huge portion of rice. And that cost me about £5.
Wow.
Not handing you by a drink.
So your
or anything.
Sugar levels from the rice is going to go woof.
Yeah.
So during that next surgery, you might end up having a bit of a crash from
your glucose. I often find myself, once I eat food in the hospital canteen, it often has, you know, this immediate, I get this postprandial slump. I eat and then I have a bit of a slump about an hour afterwards. For me, the concern is not so much about the, you know, excessive amount of carbs. I enjoy carbs because often the carb-rich foods are high in fiber. But it's the low amount of protein, it's the taste, it's the expense, and the low amount of fiber.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big believer in maintaining high amounts of fiber in your
100%.
Diet.
There's a big percentage. If you consume about 30% of your calories from fiber, then you're going to massively reduce your chance of heart disease and cancers and all sorts.
I mean, fiber, the role of fiber is underrated.
Yeah.
There was a study published which suggested that if you increase your fiber intake by just 10 grams a day, you can lower your colorectal cancer risk, your bowel cancer risk, by 10%.
Okay. So yeah, you got the facts.
Yeah, 10 grams of fiber
is
2 slices of bread and a banana. It's 10 grams.
What bread are we talking about? Are we talking about white bread or are we talking about...
Anything.
Anything.
Yeah, like, you know, even if you take white bread, for example, there's nothing wrong with white bread. 2 slices of white bread might give you 4 or 5 grams of fiber.
Yeah.
Medium to large banana, again, 4 or 5 grams of fiber. A tin of baked beans, 6 or 7 grams of fiber. Handful of nuts, again, a few grams of fiber. It's quite easy to rack up a lot of fiber in your diet. And the trade-off, 10 grams, 10% reduction in bowel cancer? Yes, please, any day of the week.
100%. And going back to, obviously, nutrition at hospitals, a lot of people, for me, were going to hospital, they haven't got much education or knowledge about good nutrition. And they're sitting there, they're ill, they get given a plate of food for being in the hospital, and they go, oh, well, I must be able to eat this at home then. This must be nutritious food because they're going, this is hospital. Hospital is good for my health.
Yeah.
It's going to save me. It's going to rescue me. It's going to make me healthier. Well, this is the type of food that I must be eating when I go home then. So they go home. Whereas if you actually give them a good nutritious plate of food, you've got all the micronutrients, all the macronutrients on one plate. They go, hang on, well, this is what I must be eating. But they're not doing that. So there's no education when you go into the hospital. It's simply antibiotics or this is going to save you, this is going to rescue, and then see you later. We'll see you in 6 months' time.
Well, I often find, you're not wrong actually on that. And I often find that patients are the first ones to say, I don't like this food.
Yeah, I've
never met a patient who says to me, can you give me a bit more of that food? Because it's really tasty.
Yeah.
They always hate it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, when you're in hospital, there's a lot of medical jargon being used to patients. And this is part of the health literacy. Health literacy is allowing patients to understand what you're telling them. And that increases compliance with the treatment plan. And me as a surgeon, I'm often consenting patients before surgery for major operations. I simplify the language as to make it as easy as possible. I don't say MI, I say heart attack. I don't say TIA, I say mini stroke. These are the risks I might tell the patients about. And I think also when it comes to food, often we advise patients who've got, you know, a flare-up of inflammatory bowel disease or who've got a colitis or something like that. We'll give some advice about diet that they should stick to for the next few weeks or months. So if someone comes in with diverticulitis, an inflammation of the colon, I would tell them, you need to be on a low residue fiber, which means a low fiber diet for the next few weeks. And then once the inflammation is settled, the flare up is settled, you need to go on a medium to high fiber diet. And I will go through them what this means specifically. So they know in their head, they're not just, oh, what's a low residue diet? Yeah. It's all jargon. Same with patients who've got gallbladder problems. I'll tell them, stick to a low fat diet. And I'll give them examples. Yeah. Eggs, salmon.
Well, my dad had gallbladder and his diet was terrible. It was a lot of butter on his bread. It was a lot of cheeses. Yeah.
Dairy, all these sort of things can increase the risk of gallbladder problems. Yeah. Because when you have
a lot of it, and in moderation, it's fine. It's like, there's obviously good sources of dairy. Like
the thing is, for me, right, I tell patients, like, it's easy to tell patients, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this. But actually explaining to them the science behind it actually makes them understand more. When you have when you consume fat, you or I consume a meal with fat, some avocado or some eggs, we get a release of a hormone called cholecystokinin. Cholecystokinin also causes the contraction of the gallbladder. So if you've got gallstones in that gallbladder and the gallbladder squeezing, it's going to be excruciating. So if you cut down the amount of fat in your diet, you don't get such a big release of CCK, cholecystokinin, so you get less chance of flare-ups of gallbladder issues.
Wow. So what should be doing? Increasing their protein intake from things like chicken, which aren't high in fat?
Yeah, I mean, the main thing is carbohydrates. Low in fat. Yeah, carbohydrates, fiber, all sorts of things. You need to somehow manage your lifestyle where you have a lower fat diet. But at the end of the day, if you've got gallbladder issues, chances are you're heading for an operation to have your gallbladder out.
Yes, I couldn't believe my dad brought them home. They were massive. I was like,
oh, they're huge.
You must be in pain.
I've seen some about that big.
Wow.
Yeah, that just filled the entire gallbladder. And you wonder
that's
why.
Just through their nutrition and their diet. Is it more diet life?
There's all sorts. I mean, there's genetic factors. There could be other medical conditions which increases their risk.
What's the biggest culprit? Is it nutrition and diet?
I would say, yeah, certainly like increased amounts of fats. But it's not for everyone. Yeah. The thing is, if you compared the incidence of gallbladder issues and gallstone problems, you know, decades ago versus now where we have more processed foods, more trans fats in the foods, where increased consumption of, you know, fatty substances and things which can raise our cholesterol, eventually the body can't deal with processing that amount of cholesterol. And often you get these, they sort of crystallize almost into cholesterol stones or bile pigment stones. And cholesterol stones are one type of gallstone. And that's a cause for a significant percentage of people.
Mate, you as a doctor must get so frustrated with seeing all this high processed food get advertised, pushed. Because you're thinking, that's just more work for me. Like, it's literally more work for me. And I'm going to help my patients, see you later, and they're going to come back in. It's a vicious cycle, isn't it? Right now.
The thing is, like, I think a lot of people know that, you know, eating 20 donuts in one sitting is not good for your health. Everyone knows that. Whether you're 7 years old or 70 years old, you know that. But the problem is not necessarily just the push of processed foods or making that cheap. It's people with power, and I'm talking about people with influence, like doctors on social media, doctors on the television, who promote ridiculous ideologies and diets and all sorts of things, and who write books about them. Yeah. And then people trust them. I saw a patient in the hospital with a book by a well-known TV doctor in the UK, and it was some crash diet book. And in the book, he suggested that you need to avoid tomatoes because it can cause this, it can cause that, do that.
Alkaline diet.
And I told that patient right there, I was a little bit abrupt. I was like, that book you're reading is complete trash. You know, please don't listen to that because I want your health to be, I want you to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, looking at all of these sort of things. And she, you know, was so, she had entrusted this book and this doctor that, you know, was a TV doctor. And this doctor doesn't even practice as a real doctor anymore.
Wow.
So, you know, that's frustrating.
With confidence, like, you could go anywhere, a bit of confidence, people are going to believe you.
All you need online is to wear some scrubs, put on a stethoscope and say you're
a
doctor.
There's so many people that aren't educated, a bit of confidence is going to win them over. So it is dangerous. And one of the questions was, can we trust all doctors? Like during the pandemic, for example, I'm not going to mention names, but there were some doctors saying this, some doctors saying this. Everyone was so confused. Do you know what I mean? It must have been difficult for you because I bet you had so many people asking you.
Yeah, of course. I think one of the things that which doesn't help is often in healthcare, we see lots of tribalism, you know, different camps form. And you think, okay, there's so many split opinions, even amongst the doctors in healthcare, who's wrong and who's right.
But surely there's a study. All right, guys, this is the study. Can everyone agree that this is a study? Can we agree that this is the information we need to give out?
Yeah, surely. And that'll be the majority of people, but there'll be slight camps which says no, you know, this and that. Yeah. And at the end of the day, we say something in academia when we're publishing research, shit in, shit out. If you put shit data in, you'll get shit data out. So you can get a meta-analysis. A meta-analysis is the highest level of evidence that you can get, okay? A meta-analysis will often combine several randomized controlled trials and analyze them. Mm-hmm. So it's qualitative and quantitative data. But even the meta-analysis can be shit data. If you analyze, if you include in your data set all these really rubbish trials, you're getting rubbish outcomes in the end. So you can't always just trust published data.
Yeah, of course.
You need to analyze the credibility and validity of that data. Is it actually good enough data to analyze in the first place?
Yeah, it's true.
You know, if I tell you that, there's an association between more people are getting shark bites when there are more ice cream sales, which means that ice cream sales cause shark bites. No, maybe when it's hot outside, more people are buying ice cream and more people are going into the water and getting bitten by sharks.
I've got a great one when a lot of people say red meat can cause cancer or heart disease. Like, no, the majority of people eating high processed food are probably eating really terrible quality meat from...
Most likely,
from the... Like we call it the, what's it, the greasy spoon cafes.
Yeah, yeah.
So those type of people are having heart disease and cancer, but people actually eating very good quality red meat, chicken, beef, etc., are probably not having high heart disease or cancer levels.
Yeah, no, I don't think there's anything wrong with red meat per se,
but what I do
advise my patients is, you know, don't have excessive amounts of red meat. And I usually give a sort of rough figure around 70 grams a day.
70 grams a day.
You know, if you're having excessive amounts of red meat on a daily basis, that will increase your risk of gut microbiome disruption, increase your risk of colorectal cancer, and this is all published data, increase your risk of other issues as well. So that's the only thing. So there's nothing wrong with, you know, moderate intake. No. With everything, it's all about moderation.
But there's also very good benefits of red meat as well, isn't
there? Yeah, of course. I mean, it's a good protein source, good quality red meat.
I always go to the butcher. Yeah. Avoid the Sainsbury's and Tesco's stuff.
The thing is, right, someone can not eat any red meat, but that is not a guarantee that you won't get bowel cancer and that you won't be unhealthy because it's all the other factors. If you're eating red meat and, you know, you're exercising well, you're training well, and you're also getting lots of fiber, that's fine. Yes. Again, it's all in moderation.
Of course, because you see this one individual, I've seen you've done actually a video on him, is he really, really promotes animal-based diet, almost like the carnivore diet. So basically says a liver, good quality red meat, and obviously no vegetables, just fruit, honey, and orange juice. Do you know who I'm talking about?
But I know who you're talking about, but the thing is, this guy, Carnivore MD, Paul Saladino, it's funny that he's got salad in his name, but he actually hates... He says kale is bullshit. He says this and this. I don't understand that. How can someone who wants to promote healthy living say that these vegetables are bullshit? Yeah. Now, the thing is, his whole point is that these plants have defense chemicals, phytochemicals, and all these other things.
Is there any truth behind that?
Yes and no. So plants have defense chemicals. That's absolutely normal. But it doesn't cause us harm. If you're having 20 bowls of spinach, that will be harmful for you. But in the kind of microscopic amounts that we consume, it's not. It's actually, there's this process called hormesis, where small amounts of stress for consuming plant defense chemicals is actually beneficial for us. The same thing as, you know, having exposure to some sort of minor stressor, like maybe having a cold shower. That process of hormesis, where we have a small amount of stress, can be beneficial for us. It can, you know, improve our cellular structure microscopically. But does it actually have a negative impact? No. You need plants in your diet.
Yeah, of course. They
have phytochemicals, flavonoids, antioxidants. These are all things which promote longevity and promote a health span.
100%. And someone living in Ireland, they had to live on potatoes and cabbage and broccoli and turnips and carrots. They couldn't have the mangoes, the tropical fruits. And they survived through the famine, didn't they?
So it's, you know what?
it's common sense, isn't it?
It's common sense, but Carnivore MD and people who are promoting all these sort of diets are often coming from a place of privilege. You know, they have... the means to just buy these high quality products and live life like that, go and train in a, you know, great gym, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But that comes with privilege. Not everyone has the opportunity to do that. They have to make do with what they've got.
Which is why we're seeing such a big obesity rates right now, because only people can only afford the highly processed stuff. You go into Iceland and you're getting chicken nuggets, you're getting 100 chicken nuggets for £3, for example. And this is what kids can, this is what parents can only afford. And it's a shame.
Listen, like a family living close to or on the poverty line.
Yes.
And who've got maybe 3 or 4 kids, they would most likely rather buy something that can last the family for the entire week than buying organic meats and all of these free range items, which will blow their entire weekly budget out of the water and would worsen their financial situation. They can't do that to survive. Sometimes, yes, they might have to eat that sort of, frozen chicken nuggets. But the problem is that is a conversation that we need to have on a higher national level.
Big time.
Not by influencers on their soapbox. It's the government maybe should make these nutritious items more accessible and cheaper.
Yes, 100% they need to, because it's just going to get worse and worse. And talking about the obesity crisis right now, because there is a crisis, I would say there is. The Health Survey for England 2021, I know that was a few years ago, estimates that 26% of adults in England are obese. Does that put more pressure on the NHS?
Well, when it comes to obesity, there are certainly consequences of that: chronic metabolic health issues, increased cardiovascular events, increased risk of various types of cancers.
And injuries as well, like broken ankles, fractures.
Yeah, of course, And all of these things will result in increased hospital admissions, increased medication usage, so and so. You know, an example would be type 2 diabetes. With excessive weight gain, you can get insulin resistance, and eventually that can transition to type 2 diabetes. Type 2 diabetes is probably one of the most underrated, but probably one of the most sinister and insidious conditions, not just from a metabolic health point of view. You know, type 2 diabetes, it can cause diabetic nephropathy. It affects your kidneys, so they just knacker out and you might end up needing dialysis. It causes diabetic neuropathy. Mm. It kind of just ruins your nerves, so you can lose sensation and you can lose your sense of balance. It causes muscle wasting. It causes, diabetic retinopathy, affects your eyes, so you can eventually go blind. All these sort of things, right?
Not forget your mental health as well.
Not affects your mental health with any chronic condition. So yes, naturally this will have an increased burden on the healthcare services and things like that. But I think it would be very arrogant for anyone to assume that, you know, people who are suffering with chronic health issues are a problem. We need to help people with these problems somehow. And that's why advances in surgery, advances in medicine will actually help that. So I've been involved in the past with weight loss surgeries, Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, gastric sleeves. These weight loss surgeries, and I have seen how dramatic the effects can be, they can actually reverse in a matter of weeks type 2 diabetes and other chronic metabolic conditions. And now, with the increased rise of these GLP-1 agonists, these weight loss injections, they can also reverse diabetes and other metabolic conditions.
So do you see a positive with these new injections?
Absolutely,
Is it positive?
So the thing is, it needs to be, you know, a note to anyone considering using these weight loss injections. With any medication, there are risks and benefits.
What you have to balance.
So one of the things which healthcare professionals and a lot of people taking these injections don't know is that with any rapid weight loss, which you can get with these weight loss injections, you'll also get a significant shift in your body composition. And that can be negative, because you can lose, alongside the fat loss, you can lose a lot of lean muscle as well. And losing lean muscle, losing bone density puts you at increased risk of injury, bone fractures, and low muscle equals lower testosterone, and it can affect you. So if you are on these weight loss injections, semaglutide or whatever you're on, you need to also have a good training regime where you're trying to maintain muscle.
Yeah.
So you want to lose that visceral fat, but also try and keep up, maintain or increase lean muscle. So you've got a good body composition.
So you can't just expect to take the injection and sit on your ass. You need to be moving. You need to be get some resistance training. You need to improve in your nutrition. So basically, you need to practice a healthy lifestyle with that injection.
The weight loss injections, even the studies, the research has shown, these are not intended to be used lifelong, maximum of a year or 2 years.
Yeah, how does it work and how often are they taking these injections?
So I believe it's a weekly injection for a certain number of weeks, and then you know, that should give you some sustained weight loss. But as soon as you stop the injections, a lot of people will regain that weight if they have not made sustainable changes to their lifestyle from a dietary point of view and an exercise point of view. Because what these weight loss injections do, specifically we're talking about GLP-1 agonists. GLP-1 in the body increases satiety. It makes you feel full, okay? It's an appetite regulator. GLP-1 agonists, they work on that more. So if you take that injection, it will make you feel full. So you'll eat less, you'll create a caloric deficit, and you'll lose weight. And you do that for a number of weeks or months, and you'll lose weight. Then the thing is, you're relying on this, biological hack, basically, to allow you to lose weight. If you remove that, the GLP-1 agonist is no longer making you more full or increasing your satiety. So you're back to your normal appetite level. So you consume more and you could gain weight. So in that period where you're using that injection or whatever, you need to make those changes where, okay, let me get into a regular exercise routine. Let me optimize my sleep. Let me eat more fiber in my diet. Let me increase the volume of food I eat and also, adjust certain things in my diet so you have sustainable changes to continue whatever weight you want to lose or may not want to lose.
Will these patients be getting that information you're saying now? Will they get that help? Will they get that encouragement? Will they get that information?
I can't say for sure, but what I will say...
Because I can see a lot of people yo-yoing. I personally don't think it's a good thing. Being an online coach, when I work with my online clients, I'm like, cool, this is what we need to do. We need to reduce your calorie intake. We need to improve your diet, find healthy alternatives. We're going to increase your step count and we're going to start some resistance training, slow but steady, and increase it. But that maybe is the type of person who is willing and able to do that. So are these injections for the type of people who have just got no go in them?
No, so this type of injection, it's a very specific cohort of people. So, we've heard all the stories about Elon Musk and Chelsea Handler and all these Hollywood and A-list celebrities taking these injections to get shredded or lose some weight.
Okay.
It is not for the average person or someone who is just slightly overweight.
Yep.
It is not for someone looking to get shredded, going to Magaluf and then, get in good shape before their wedding or on a stag do. It's not for that person. It is for someone who has a very high, risk of chronic metabolic conditions, who've got cardiovascular issues, who have trouble controlling their weight and who've got a lot of weight, which puts them at an increased risk of various health conditions. It is for them. And a lot of these people have not managed to lose weight. And they've tried various diets. They've tried exercise and it's not worked for them. And this can be a solution to allow them to have some weight loss to reduce their risk of metabolic conditions and various adverse events. It's for a select group of people who are at a higher risk of these problems, not for the average.
You have to go and see a doctor before. You can't just walk into Boots like you can with Viagra now and go, I want some of those things.
Yeah, you can't just buy it off the counter. It's a prescription only. But there's also now a private prescription service. And that is my concern, where that will be abused by people who've got maybe just a little extra few kilos they may want to lose. They think, oh, let me get on that quick injection. You need to know that these injections, if you're just at a slightly overweight level, the risk of your massive loss of lean muscle that you can have in that is not worth the risk of that. In addition to the other risk, you can have an increased risk of pancreatitis and inflammation of your pancreas, gastritis, other GI issues, diarrhea. There's all sorts of associated risks that if you're just slightly overweight, it is not for you.
Yeah.
You need to stick to other things. This is for the people who are at a higher risk category.
Good. I'm glad we stated that for sure. Over the last couple of months, I've been using Live Jacket Skin Protection in my daily routine, a brand on a mission to stop the rise in skin cancer. Skin cancer rates have doubled since the 90s and are forecast to double again over the next 20 years. So not only is Live Jacket Daily SPF Moisturizer protecting my skin from UV rays, but from all weather conditions. I'm also quite picky with how products feel on my skin, but this stuff is weightless. For more information, visit livejacketskin.com and give them a follow at Live Jacket Skin. And coming saying on to the whole weight management, female weight management, I find is far more complex than male. Obviously, I'm an online client, as I mentioned before. With males, it's simply, look, get your steps up, increase your protein, and let's get some strength training and do a bit of cardio. Let's do a few 5K runs here and there. With women, it is far more complex. Why is that? I know it's the menstrual cycle, premenopausal, hormonal, but obviously I want you to go into detail.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, sometimes it's easier for men to get a six pack or do all of these things because they'll often have a, you know, a lower amount of essential body fat that they need to maintain various functions. Women have a higher percentage of essential body fat that they need for various functions, including reproductive function, you know, maintaining all of these other things as well. But I think it would be very, again, arrogant to assume that everyone is the same and everyone has the same struggles or whatever. And I think, you know, you mentioned obviously the menstruation and various hormones as well. When a woman is going through a period, the concern for that person is not to lose weight. No. You know, it's just dealing with often, you know, crippling abdominal and pelvic pain and all sorts of, you know, mental health fluctuations that are going on during a menstrual cycle or, you know, other things like that. And, that's the crux right there. I mean, there are certain things that you can put into place to attempt someone to, you know, get fit, you know, all these other things. But it's not always that simple. And also the other point is men on average have a higher amount of testosterone. And obviously testosterone makes it easier to gain muscle and lose fat.
And when you gain muscle, you increase your metabolism.
Exactly. So for all those risks, you know, women have a lower metabolic rate on average than men, have a lower testosterone than men. There's all these, you know, intricacies.
I have clients who's saying calorie deficit, especially when I ring up my leads and try and get them on board. They say, Brett, I've tried absolutely everything, every diet you can think of. I'm doing the whole calorie deficit. I'm still not losing weight. And obviously I get them on board. I change up their nutrition, improve their nutrition, increase their protein intake, try and get them doing strength training so their metabolism does increase. But it is still a lot. You see the males, their results have come a lot quicker. Don't say in my female clients, 100% they get the results in the end of the day, but it is far more complex. Is it more than just calorie deficit for some people? Calorie deficit for some people?
You know, I think, again, it's unfair to say all you need is eat less, move more.
Yes.
Okay, that is a simple equation, but in practice, there's, again, loads of nuance and complexities. How someone's mood is, how they can adhere to a certain thing, the lifestyle factors, can they actually do a certain thing right now? You know, there's societal factors, financial factors, various things. Yeah. But at the crux of it, there's still the deficit is required in some manner, whether you need to increase your, whenever someone increases activity or lowers the consumption, that deficit still needs to be made, but it's not easy. It's not easy. And that's the arrogance that some people can have. Oh, so-and-so is not losing weight because they're probably eating too much and they're not moving enough. That person may be, you know, not eating, cutting down their calories to a very low amount, maybe trying a 500 calorie crash diet and things like that. But I think that's not helpful because often these restrictive things that we put ourselves through to go on diets often results in a sort of a rebound crash where the next day you might go over because you've had enough.
Well, that happens a lot during the week. But on the weekend, you get your Domino's, you get your garlic herb dip, you have your Coke. Hidden calories and everything. And that's where it's my job to educate them, try and keep them on a healthy meal plan. And I don't want them to be too obsessive with their calorie intake, but they, at least they have the guidance and they learn from that. For example, I get a lot of stick from various of people saying you shouldn't have your clients counting their calories. It can cause eating disorders, etc. I understand. But I make sure when I bring my client on, they're in a healthy mindset. So there's a lot of red flags. If I'm like eating disorder, that's not me. I'm not skilled enough to do that. If it's someone I go, okay, they're going to be disciplined. They've got some sort of education and they're really going to smash this and be disciplined with it. They're the type of client I know who 100% get results and not going to abuse the whole calorie tracking and the macro. But for 4 to 6 months, if you can just track what you're eating, I guarantee you, in forever in your life, you're going to have a better understanding of portion control. How many calories are in an avocado, for example? Yeah. How many calories are in a chocolate bar? Of course, you can have a little bit of chocolate here and there. However, you need to understand the calories in that. One Freddo or whole dairy milk?
You know, I think, you know, the whole diet, health and wellness space online, there are so many polarized camps.
Yeah.
There's, you know, you've got intuitive eating, and you've got the sort of people who are zealots at tracking every single macro. But often there's never this happy medium in between that. And I think to get to that stage where you're maybe intuitively eating and you kind of know roughly what your requirements are, maybe at some point you do need to just identify how many calories in that or whatever. Yeah. And I think it's wrong for someone to say you must track your calories. Yep. It's also wrong for someone to say you shouldn't track your calories because it could do that. There's some sort of balance needs to be had, right? Where actually, okay, I'm going to, you know, this restaurant and I roughly know if I have a salad, if I have some chicken and some chips, that's going to be around this much.
Yeah.
You're not counting at all, but you know that's going to feel make you feel full. Mm. And you're also making those smart choices that what I'm eating is nutritious, it tastes good, it's what I want. It's also packed with protein and fiber. So for me, when I eat out or when I train or whatever, or just when I'm at home eating, I know that if I have one donut, that's not going to ruin my life or ruin my health. No. But I also know that I'm going to have loads of vegetables for dinner later on and I'm going to be fine. I balance everything in my day. I don't care about what I eat. As long as, like I said before, I'm having epic dumps, I'm sleeping well, I'm training well, I'm running around, I can lift heavy weights, I'm happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care that I don't have a six pack.
No.
I don't care that, you know, I don't look a certain way, I have 20-inch biceps or whatever.
Yeah.
For me, all those other things are more important and just being happy physically and mentally.
100%. And what's your thought on calories on menus? Is that a positive or is that a negative? Because some people's a positive, some people's a negative. It's a debate, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was at roasting on Sunday and two people got the chicken simply because the beef had 300 more calories in. But they wanted the beef.
And I just,
do you know what I mean? So I said, have the beef. If you want the beef, have the beef. Chicken comes, chicken was dry as anything.
Me personally, I it doesn't make a difference to me.
Yeah.
So I can see how it can affect some people with eating disorders or body dysmorphia, how it can really take over their lives. I actually was out yesterday with some friends in London and I went to a Mexican place and they had the calories on underneath all the taco options.
Did that stop you
Made no difference. I wanted the buttermilk chicken tacos with the pickled onion.
Yeah.
I got that.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't matter. That was more calorific than whatever the other taco. I don't care. That's what I wanted in my mind. Even if that was going to be 2,000 calories, I was eating that. It wasn't, obviously.
Because that has come in to try and stop the 25% obesity level. That has been brought in for that reason.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to make a huge difference in that. There's so many other things that we can fix that's aside from the calories on the menu.
Making healthy food cheaper.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing we can do. This was like
supporting our farmers.
Yeah, this is the low-hanging fruit. And yeah, it might help some people make some educated choices and they might be shocked. Oh, I didn't realize so-and-so had this many calories.
Yeah,
so
course.
It just may help them give them some context and relevance as to other things.
Yeah, but like everything in life, you can't please everyone. Some people are it's gonna benefit others and it's not gonna benefit others.
So maybe the option is having two menus where one has the calories and one doesn't, so everyone's happy.
Yeah. Would you like one with me or would you like that?
Or even like online menus where you can click on it and to reveal the calories, you know.
Yeah, 100%.
That's it.
Yeah, cool. We agree on that. So gut health, have I spoken with my previous guests on my podcast, but I'd love to hear what you think is the leading cause of bad gut health. What are the most severe cases of bad gut health that you've seen and how should we improve our gut health?
So bad gut health, you know, you can be born with certain conditions where your gut health is affected. So inflammatory bowel conditions, we know more and more, are due to abnormalities and shifts in the microbiome and the specific diversity of the microbiome in the certain populations. You think of your gut as a battleground, right? And you've got the armies of good bacteria, several strains of good bacteria, and you've got several strains of bad bacteria. And kind of the good ones are always keeping the bad ones in check. But sometimes you might do certain things which actually inhibit the good guys and the bad guys start rising up. This is how a simple analogy to see your gut health. The things which you can do to worsen your gut health, like I mentioned, excessive amounts of red meat, having high amounts of ultra-processed food, a low-fiber diet, having the same boring diet day in, day out. And what I mean by that is not having variety in your diet, the variety in food groups, variety in color. So you need a diverse range of things. So lots of different plants, some aubergine to get the purple, some tomatoes to get the red. You know, you got your greens with the cucumbers or the iceberg lettuce, whatever. You want a variety. Other things, chronic prolonged courses of antibiotics. Antibiotics are life-saving, but they're also like nuclear bombs for your gut. They just randomly attack all the bacteria, good and bad. So it does the job, but sometimes it can have the collateral damage. So there's various sort of things that, you know, you can do that are controllable for you. There's things which you can't control. If you've got an autoimmune condition like Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, any colitis or inflammation of the bowel, that's something that you cannot control. But you can control these things that I mentioned. You know, if you've got a cold or flu, don't just go and take some antibiotics because it's a viral infection. That's not going to work.
Yes.
And you're just ruining your gut health. You know, eating excessive amounts of takeaway all the time. Again, ultra-processed food are going to affect your gut. So there's all these kind of things which can affect your guts. And also other things, commonly people take non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medication like ibuprofen or Nurofen. Chronically taking that can also worsen your gut microbiome.
A lot of people are addicted to that.
Addicted to that. Alcohol, that can also worsen your gut microbiome. So there's a lot of things under your control. Now, to have good gut health, you basically need to not do those things. Now, a lot of people are obsessed with probiotics. I've said time and time again, probiotics that you buy over the counter, for the average person, that's not going to do anything.
We're talking Actimels.
Yeah. You go to the supermarket, you see on the shelf all those kind of things, you pick them up and you drink it. For most people, that's not going to do anything because it's like pissing in the wind.
Yes.
Your gut microbiome has so many different strains of bacteria. We don't know if that strain that you buy in that little probiotic drink that you've bought in the supermarket is going to work for you. And when you ingest something, it has to go through your stomach acid, has to go through the entire digestive system. By the time it gets to your gut, those bacteria that you've consumed might be dead or won't be able to inhabit and populate your colon. So it just ends up as expensive urine or expensive poo, right?
What about things like Sinproof?
Again, for the average person, this is not going to work because, or it's overhyped. Because the thing is, unless you've got some specific bowel conditions, you've got antibiotic associated diarrhea, you've got some rare, you know, disorders of the bowel, you've got certain subtypes of inflammatory bowel disease, you've got, you know, proctitis and inflammation of the rectum, inflammation of the colon, certain inflammatory bowel disease. If you're in the select categories, there's actually certain conditions where probiotics might work. And even then, it's prescribed probiotics which have specific strains. Just blindly throwing random strains is not going to be beneficial, even if you're in that category of people. I have prescribed medically probiotics for patients who've had persistent diarrhea after certain operations.
Yeah.
And we trial some probiotics, they might get some benefit, but these are medical grade probiotics, not just the stuff that a average consumer can buy. It's all hype.
Because there's, look, they say the three Ks, it's kimchi, kefir and kombucha. All hype?
No. I think these things, these fermented foods like kimchi is and homemade kefir that you can make, fermented food are a great source of prebiotics and probiotics and even postbiotics, the kind of breakdown chemicals of some of these gut bacteria, butyric acid and things like that, these fatty acids, which are quite important. Fatty acid chains.
But I guess they're more natural. So you're saying go for the three Ks, the kimchis, the kefirs, if I said it right, and kombuchas, and maybe the Actimels, the stuff that is just on the shelf.
What I would say is that you touched on a good point there. If you can make at home or buy these food items, which are fermented, like you can make your own kimchi at home. You can make your own sauerkrauts at home.
Yep.
You can make your own pickled onions at home. Those are fermented foods and cheeses, you know, Greek yogurts.
Yep.
These are all easy things that you can buy and that will give you all of those
whole foods.
Ingredients.
Whole foods
that you can have. You don't need to buy, you know, kombucha bottles. Again, I think that is a lot of hype.
Yep.
You can make kombucha at home.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a bit of effort and, you know, read up online what the ingredients are. All of those things are great for your gut health.
Are they going to do any harm, these piped up products?
it's unlikely that all these things will do harm to you. The only harm it will do is to your wallet. They're very expensive, these kind of things.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
You know, some of these things that you mentioned, if you're buying it on a regular basis, on a monthly basis, you'd be better off spending that money on a gym membership or
online coach.
Real food. online coaching. Yeah, yeah. Do something else instead of buying those things. Very expensive they are.
Yeah, it is expensive. And a lot of these kombuchas as well, they've got a lot of sweeteners in, and sweeteners get a lot of backlash or a lot of debate. And we were talking it before that obviously we started this podcast. So let's talk about sweeteners for right now. Are they bad for our gut health? Are they dangerous? Or is it nothing to be too worried about?
So again, there's a lot of nuance. In medicine, there's never any pure black and white, you know, things.
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to artificial sweeteners. There is not... You've seen more and more studies come out now and that people are saying sweeteners have an increased risk of cancers and disrupting your gut microbiome and things like that. But overwhelmingly, there are more studies which suggest that they don't affect those in the same way that these other limited studies do. Now, in the future, when more research comes out about artificial sweeteners and their effect on the gut microbiome and cancer risk and various other things, maybe we'll have more and more evidence to say maybe they're not as good. Are sweeteners good for us? No. Are sweeteners bad for us? Also unlikely, I would say no. Because if you look at the risk versus benefit of taking sweeteners, a lot of people will take sweeteners to reduce their calorie consumption because they want to lose weight and they want to improve their body composition or just be more healthy and cut out the full sugared items. Instead of drinking a full fat, full sugar Coke, you're having a Coke Zero, which has artificial sweeteners in it. And maybe you cut out a few hundred calories a day because you're not drinking all that sugar. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's having a better impact for your oral and dental health because you're cutting down sugar, but also you might be losing weight. And if you lose weight, that might improve your metabolic profile, which improves your overall health in various other things in your life. Mm-hmm. So I see sweeteners, artificial sweeteners, can be a great way for those people to achieve what they want. So we're comparing sweeteners versus the full sugared items.
Yes.
Sweeteners are clearly better than having the full sugar item of those things. Now, someone having the artificial sweeteners versus no artificial sweetener, yeah, sure, I'd prefer no artificial sweeteners at all. But we're not living in that society where someone is trying to wean themselves off a certain item that they love to eat and they're going on to the zero calorie version of it.
It's a step, isn't it?
It's a step, yeah.
But then some people might say, well, I only have one Coke a day, but I'm changing that to a Diet Coke. But because Diet Coke has no calories, I'm going to have four of those.
Yeah, maybe that's not the right approach,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, that's not the right approach. There's different, I guess,
sort of moderation. You know, you can't have, you know, a copious amounts of artificial sweetener all the day because... Maybe they'll have some effect, we don't know. But they are safe. I mean, if someone is having one or two, you know, Coke Zeros a day, fine.
Well, yeah, and I said to you before, I've actually cut my Pepsi Max. I love Pepsi Max. I used to have three a day, especially on my stressful days. And I'm on the laptop and I'm working. I need a bit of caffeine. I'll have another Pepsi Max. I'm thirsty. I have a bit of Pepsi Max. I've actually stopped that. I'm drinking something like this now. It's called Dash Water. But again, like you said, for the privilege, this is very expensive. It's a lot more expensive than Pepsi Max. Zero calories. Okay, is there a little bit sweetener? Maybe, but not as much in a Diet Coke. And it is healthier than you than a Diet Coke. But like you said, maybe I am a little bit privileged where I earn good money, so I'm able to afford this.
Exactly. I mean, at the end of the day, I think the bottom line is that artificial sweeteners in moderation are not bad for you.
Yeah.
You know, and the full sugared versions can be bad for you. If you're having one full sugar Coke, again, that's not going to be bad
for
you.
No, of course not.
But if that's a consistent thing, you're having several a day, maybe you want to look at changing that.
Yeah, 100%. Spot on, mate. Spot on. If there's three things we can do to improve our health and essentially have a better quality of life, what are those three things? And you only can stick to those three things.
Better quality of life. Increasingly, as I've gone through night shifts and you know, stressful hours at work, for me, sleep is a pillar of everything.
How can we improve our sleep?
What I do, I'll also tell you about what I do when I'm working around shifts, is that I invested in some blackout curtains in my room.
Yeah.
So they're quite heavy blackout curtains. So they actually block out.
Where can we get these from, IKEA?
Oh, you can get them, online. You just search for blackout curtains. I'm sure you find they're quite cheap as well. And they're really heavy. So they block out sound as well as the light. Oh, wow. Because I live quite near a busy road. Mm-hmm. So it's important for me not to have that noise, mm-hmm. you know, cars going by, honking, whatever. So it blocks out sound. It's almost like I'm in like a little recording studio. It blocks out the sound, blocks out the lights. I also make sure that I recently installed some sort of a thermostat in my room so I can control the temperature of my room. I've got like a sort of an air conditioning unit in my room. So I can keep it chilled. I like to keep it around 20, 21 degrees. I don't know if that is specifically the optimal temperature, but for me, it helps. Yeah. And for all humans, you know, from a physiological point of view, a slightly cooler temperature gets you to sleep faster. You know, it reduces that sleep induction time. And also I stick to religiously a sleep-wake cycle, which is consistent daily, even on weekends. I don't lie in on weekends. On a weekday, I get up at around 6:30 now, mm-hmm. and I'll be in for work, and I'll go to bed every day around sort of 10:30, 11 p.m.
Okay.
On weekends, I'll get up maybe 15 minutes later or 20 minutes later because my body is used to waking up and sleeping at the same time. So I'm happy. I don't feel the need to lie in. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, I have afternoon naps on weekends or days off. I'll have a cheeky 90-minute nap from around 1:30 to 3 p.m.
Which is so crucial for you being a surgeon.
Yeah, and I don't drink caffeine at all.
Okay.
No caffeine at all.
Why is that?
I've never enjoyed the taste of caffeine or coffee or tea or anything like that. I mean, I've had it before in like an energy drink or something, but I'm not addicted to it. I don't
need
it. I have
one coffee a day, but if I have more than one coffee a day, it makes me crash.
So that's the thing. So, you know, the coffee, the caffeine specifically, it's not giving you any more energy. It's stealing energy from later on to give it to you now. You know, it's just blocking the buildup of adenosine. Mm-hmm. And eventually when this caffeine wears off, those adenosine receptors are open for the adenosine molecules and they all latch on in one go. So you get that sudden, you know, sleepless crash.
Well, when you have caffeine, I've got more energy now to go and smash a workout or walk my dog. And that's exhausting me even more. So when, it comes down, I'm even double exhausted.
Because you're alert more with caffeine, so you can stay awake for longer. And the more you're awake, adenosine keeps building up throughout the day. And enough adenosine binds onto those adenosine receptors and you suddenly have a crash of energy and you feel sleepy.
Well, I did a poll on my Instagram and I was just intrigued to see if people got the same symptoms as me when it came to coffee. And some people say, I have 5 coffees a day and it's completely fine. And there are some people say, I can't drink coffee. So it's quite individual, isn't it?
It's individual. And I mean, the only thing I would say is that, I mean, if you look online about the half-life of caffeine, it will vary as to what it will tell you. Anything from 5 to 8 hours, it will vary. For me, if someone is drinking coffee, say your bedtime is 11 p.m., I would say at least in the 5 to 8 hours before bed, you do not want to be drinking any coffee. So probably the safest place after midday, maybe 1, 2 p.m. at most, no more coffee after then.
I think that's spot on. And a lot of people I've written and seen on Twitter, and obviously you see a lot of these Instagram reels. You watch 15 seconds, you go, oh, okay, cool. So I'm not saying for certain, but because I guess our concentration span changes after those 15 seconds. Yeah. But I remember hearing around 10 to 11 o'clock is ideal, not when you straight away wake up. Get some sunlight, get some fresh air, wake up naturally, and then hit your caffeine around 11 o'clock.
Yeah, I remember I was on like this kind of daytime TV show where they was asking me about health stuff. And people were shocked when I said, don't drink coffee first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. This was about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reason for that is that there's nothing wrong with drinking coffee first thing when you wake up. But if you want to get, you know, the real power of caffeine, if you delay it to after your cortisol rise in the morning, where you get a natural dip in the sort of mid-morning or the natural dips throughout the day, you get more bang for your buck with the coffee.
Yeah, 100%. All right, so we discuss about sleep. That's number one. We've got two more things.
Oh, yeah. So, sleep, fiber.
Fiber.
Right, 30 grams of fiber a day. And it's not just any old fiber. It's got to be a combination of both insoluble and soluble fibers.
Okay, what's insoluble and what's soluble fibers?
So, you know, you kind of like soluble fibers would be, you know, things like oats, etc.
Okay.
And then your insoluble fibers, you know, your things like legumes and, you know,
so your quinoa, your lentils.
So kind of insoluble fibers as well. You can think about your nuts and all these sort of things, you know, plant-based foods.
Yeah.
basically, the insoluble fiber acts as a sort of rake to sweep your intestines and kind of just scrape everything in your colon. Mm. And the soluble fibers helps to bulk up the stool and makes it nice and soft. So you need a combination of both types of fibers that is actually good for both your gut bacteria and the colonic function as well. And it's important also not to excessively go beyond an excessively high amount of fiber, because that can cause bloating, stomach cramps, and all these sort of things. But I think most people need to worry about getting enough fiber rather than eating too much.
Okay.
So 30 grams of fiber a day is important. Okay. Because it can also lower your cholesterol, lower your colorectal cancer risk as well. Mm-hmm.
Oh, wicked. So we've got sleep, we've got fiber. What's number three?
Number three, and a lot of people may, you know, disagree, it is actually wearing sunscreen on a daily basis.
Well, as you say that, Life Jacket sponsored this podcast. SPF. Okay,
So yeah, I mean, for me, like,
even in a cloudy day like today, it's a must, isn't
100%.
It?
I mean, even if you're living in a northern hemispheric country, somewhere like the UK, where it's always cloudy, overcast, UV light still percolates through. Even if you're sitting in a, you know, in a cafe by a window, UV light can still make its way through the window. The UV glass, the glass will block some of the rays, but it can still get through. So sunscreen is one of the genuine anti-aging things that you can do. Mm-hmm. You know, it reduces this kind of photo-aging that you get, skin elastosis, and it just protects the skin. So for a quick low-hanging fruit to improve your skin health, sunscreen is a no-brainer.
100%. So there you're free. I absolutely love that. Mine would be a little bit different, but again, coming from a personal trainer approach, mine would be increase your protein levels, get your sleep. I think that's massively important. Yep. And resistance training. That would be my three.
Yeah.
And sunlight, vitamin D on your face is really key. But look, your three are perfect. Okay, let's just go, because we're running out of time now, mate, because we've been flying through. This is going so cool. You could talk all day. Will we always have an NHS? And also, let's quickly discuss about what's happening in NHS right now. Obviously, there's protests right now, and rightly so, I guess.
Yeah, so junior doctor strikes right now, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, 13th, 14th, 15th of March. And a lot of people fail to understand. They think that these greedy junior doctors want more money, want a pay rise. It's actually not a pay rise, and the semantics are key here. It's a pay restoration.
Yes.
There's been a huge pay cut in real terms from 2008 and, you know, a couple of decades ago. And the doctors want to pay restoration to what it should be, you know, in keeping with inflation and all these other things. It's not asking for more money than they're actually owed. It's just a restoration of pay. And I think it's important that junior doctors get that, because these are people who are saving lives. They're not junior doctors. These are doctors who have often been working as doctors for 10 plus years.
Yeah, mad, isn't it?
So they're not junior.
Well, I've got something here. Someone put it on their Instagram and said, a prep manga has announced it will pay up to £14.10 per hour. A junior doctor makes just £14 an hour.
So yes. So what I read similar to that is that, you know, a barista at Costa Coffee earns £14.10 an hour.
Yeah.
A first year junior doctor earns £14.09 an hour.
That's mad.
And yeah, that's crazy.
That's crazy. And it's quite easy. I'm not, no disrespect to people that work at Costa or work at Pret, but anyone can really get a job at Pret or Costa Coffee, right?
You know,
whereas becoming a junior doctor, you've got to go through some crazy studying, like years, like three, four, 5 years, right? To get to the top.
Yeah, I would expect, you know, a first year junior doctor to be on more than £14 an hour. And to be honest, what they're asking for is not a lot more. I think they're asking for going from £14 an hour to £19 an hour.
Yeah.
So it's not a huge amount that...
And what would that £19 do? It would literally be able to them to buy good nutritious food to keep them alert so they get good at their job, instead of buying the canteen food, as we mentioned before.
Exactly. It's just a better just quality of life, you know, of pay their rent, pay their bills, have a family, have a, you know, normal quality of life. It's a start.
Because what's going to happen? More people are going to go, Joe, well, I can't be asked to be a doctor if they get paid that.
People are leaving. People are leaving the NHS and to go to Australia, Canada, the USA to work there because better climate, better working conditions, better pay. And we are bleeding, you know, staffing. We're just losing all our staff, both doctors and nurses. And also they're just quitting healthcare full stop and just going on to other careers, banking, all sorts.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, 100%. I guess during the pandemic, that was a big, that was a tough period for all of you doctors. It was relentless. Yeah. So a lot of people, a lot of doctors and nurses were probably thinking, fuck that again.
Yeah, we don't want to face something like that again. And at the end of the day, you know, claps doesn't pay the bills.
No, of course. I thought the first clap was great. I thought the second, third, fourth, fifth, I was like, okay, this is
it was like a weekly thing, wasn't it? Yeah. Like, was it every Thursday or something? Yeah. There's some sort of clap. And I was like, yeah great. But I prefer if the government showed appreciation with, you know, finances.
100%. Well, look, let's end it on that. I think that was a great conversation, mate. I'm sure we could have spoken for another 2 hours.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we will again. But look, that's some great content in there as well for obviously both of our Instagrams, et cetera, which I'm sure a lot more people will see. But mate, thank you for coming on the podcast, Facts Over Feelings. There was a lot of facts in there. And I think a lot of people get a lot out of that. So cheers, mate. Love that.
Thanks for having me on, man.
Thank you for listening to that episode. If you enjoyed it, please share on your socials and don't forget to subscribe. If you want more information about my online coaching services and get it done, then don't hesitate to message me at Bradley Simmons on Instagram.